ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
My government is concerned with the fight against inflation. Peter Dutton's concerned about fighting culture wars.
And I think if the Prime Minister wants to renege on an election commitment he's taken to the last two elections, I think he should call an election.
The housing system is cooked in this country.
And I was praying that the Minister and the government would finally wake up to themselves and do the right thing.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis from RM Breakfast and Q&A joining you from Wurundjeri Country here in Melbourne.
And I'm Frank Kelly, host of Saturday Extra on the Gadigal land, the Eora Nation in Sydney. And soon we're going to be joined on The Party Room by a Party Room newbie, Kate McClymont, Chief Investigative Reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald, and PK, I think we can agree, an absolute legend of journalism. She's going to be talking about the Bruce Lehman failed defamation case against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson and that bombshell judgment from the Federal Court Judge Justice Lee that Bruce Lehman raped Brittany Higgins at Parliament House back in 2019. So we're going to talk about that soon. But first, PK, it's been a horrific week for Australians, in particular Sydneysiders, still reeling from the horrors of the Bondi Junction attack over the weekend, in which six people were killed by a mentally unwell man who went on a knife-wielding rampage. And then just 2 days later, another stabbing, this time the target an Assyrian Orthodox bishop during a live-stream church service in Western Sydney, an absolute horror show that was beamed out live, quickly deemed a terrorist incident by New South Wales Police, who said the young man's comments and actions pointed to, quote, religious-motivated extremism. And PK, that wasn't even the end of the violence.
No, Fran. In what the Premier in New South Wales, Chris Minns, has since deemed a combustible situation, riots broke out following the attack on the bishop. An uncontrolled crowd of around 500 people descended on that church. Police cars were smashed, projectiles were thrown at police officers and paramedics, injuring some of those. Mob violence here. People demanding essentially an eye for an eye, right? This is that sort of vigilante behaviour. Multi-faith leaders were quick out of the gate condemning the actions of the young man who attacked the bishop, who's in custody, calling for unity and calm in the wake of the event. You know, everyone who had the power to do it or a platform was trying to desperately to bring down the temperature because it was a real breaking point in that community. And the same sentiment was shared by our political leaders, both state and federal, who did condemn the actions of both the perpetrator and the subsequent rioters.
This is a disturbing incident. There is no place for violence in our community. There is no place for violent extremism. We are a peace-loving nation. This is a time to unite, not divide as a community and as a country.
But the opposition has been critical of the government's approach. The Shadow Defence Minister, Andrew Hastie, told me on RM Breakfast that the Prime Minister needs to send stronger signals that he's serious about national security and social cohesion.
I think this is our most severe test for social cohesion, which is why Anthony Albanese's leadership is so important. And I think he can be stronger. He can start by restoring Directors General of ASIS and ASIO to his National Security Committee of Cabinet. I think that's a huge oversight.
That comment from Shadow frontbencher Andrew Hastie came after his leader, Peter Dutton, the leader of the opposition, offered bipartisan support to the government in the wake of the dual stabbing events. How do you think the political response worked, Fran?
It's complex, but it's obvious in a way. I mean, the opposition's major line of political attack for some time now against Anthony Albanese is that he's a weak leader, he's weak on national security, he's weak on border security. And these comments of Andrew Hastie's that, you know, I think the PM could be stronger, feed directly into that. So the question then is, was the Prime Minister's response strong enough? On Saturday night, he stood up alongside the AFP Commissioner, condemn the Bondi attacks, and to more importantly, I think, to reassure Australians and focus on the positive, the acts of bravery from ordinary citizens and from the paramedics and the police. So it was a speech to reassure, and I think it was the right tone. On Tuesday morning, after the church stabbing in Western Sydney had been declared a terror attack, as we heard there, the PM urged calm, he stressed national unity. Faith leaders got called together by the Premier. The National Security Committee of Cabinet was convened. The PM then stood up alongside the head of ASIO and the AFP and talked about a joint task force that's investigating the radicalisation of this individual. At these early stage of these investigations, I'm not sure what else a Prime Minister could or should do, but these are certainly moments when a leader needs to step up. And what we want to make sure is this doesn't spiral out into anything more. I mean, I think it's very helpful that the bishop who was stabbed, Bishop Marmari Emmanuel, has released now an audio statement basically saying he's praying for the 16-year-old who allegedly attacked him and urging people to, you know, act as Jesus would act, which is not for an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So I think that sort of response certainly does help.
That's right. And there are things that are coming out of this in a political sense, Fran. I mean, we've got the government now talking about new proposed federal laws to try and deal with falsehoods on social media platforms. What we saw in this particular attack was the role of these social media giants and social harm spreading. Now we've got Michelle Rowland, who's the federal minister, talking about dealing with that with stronger laws. The Premier in New South Wales, Chris Minns, has backed that proposed federal law. And I think, you know, in the past when they've talked about laws like this, there's always this free speech issue that's raised. I reckon that dynamic has shifted significantly since these very different attacks. But the way online these have really gone through the community, it's nothing short of alarming. Also, the sharing of the content, of this, the stabbing is just, it's the reason so many people turned up for the riot. Because it was being live streamed.
Yeah, but it was being live streamed. I mean, they can't stop that. That's a decision by the church. It was the video of the attack, I think the issue is it stayed up for so long, wasn't it?
That's right.
That was the issue, even after they were being directed by the government's agency to take it down. It didn't come down quickly enough. I mean, I'm not so sure that the free speech arguments won't still cause problems for the government. I heard the Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, this week talking about their bill for misinformation, disinformation. You know, that is being strongly opposed by not just the opposition and not just the Greens, but by a whole lot of community groups and religious groups. So I'm not sure that the government is going to have an easy path there, but you're right. This notion of misinformation, which we saw play such a role and such a, I think, destructive role during the Voice referendum, a role that was very harmful to Indigenous communities in particular, we saw it just crack into action here with the Bondi attacks first, when a poor young 20-year-old man with a Jewish surname got blamed, and that stayed, that blame was there being broadcast on free-to-air TV. So these are real issues, and the platforms need to do much better in addressing and responding to these things.
That's right. Look, the government basically has spent the entire week responding to these two tragedies in the country, and they're tragedies that we're still trying to make sense of. We're going to just park that now, and we'll have a broader conversation with Kate McClymont about, you know, the way you always want to improve as a country at the end of these moments, right? You can't ever change what's happened, but you can change the way you respond next time. So we'll talk about that. But there was another big story this week, Fran, and big defence news. Defence Minister Richard Marles unveiling the government's long-awaited dollars behind the National Defence Strategy. They've revealed plans to increase defence spending by another $50 billion over the next decade, boosting defence spending to what will end up being 2.4% of GDP within 10 years.
These increases will see annual defence spending almost double over the next 10 years to $100 billion in the financial year 33-34. It will see defence spending as a proportion of gross domestic product projected to increase to around 2.4% by 2033-34.
Now, PK, those are big numbers. You know, $100 billion in the financial year 33-34 sounds like a big investment. You know, 2.4% of GDP is huge compared to the levels under the last Labor government, the Rudd-Gillard government. Defence spending went as low as 1.7% of GDP, which is, so we've now got many, many more billions being promised. Mind you, these are different times. The government spend will also be boosted by $72.8 billion of what they call reprioritised spending. In other words, dumping plans for things like more jet strike fighters, scrapping the building of two Navy support vessels. Instead, these new dollars will be shifted to buy more autonomous vehicles, drones and long-range strike capability, amongst other things. So it's a real rebalancing and reshifting of dollars as well as more dollars.
Yeah, it's a beefing up of the Navy, particularly, and Australia's maritime capability, and essentially that watering down of the Army's dominance in our national defence. And the Minister, I've got to say, I thought it was one of his best addresses at the National Press Club. He was quite clear about what the threat was.
He sure was.
He really was. So he's been criticised before in the government and for not being clear enough when we know that they are really referring to China. He was quite clear, I thought, about that, even though he's been criticised for not being clear enough from the opposition. I don't agree. I thought he was quite clear.
Well, he said it many times in this statement the other day, didn't he? Many times.
Totally. And he talked about the role we have in the region and what he's worried about too, that it was the shipping lines in relation to trade, that we need to be able to respond in those circumstances. So I thought that he really explained the situation quite well. The opposition isn't satisfied. They labelled the strategy a leadership test for Richard Marles, were quick to criticise the plan, which the Shadow Defence Minister Andrew Hastie says due to inflation would leave the ADF worse off and a weaker force. So effectively claiming this was a cut in spending.
Yeah, that's disputed. The government says if you look at the figures, it's clearly an increase on where the Morrison government had left defence spending and projected spending when they left office. Andrew Hastie now says in government the coalition would increase spending above 2.4%, but, you know, that's a significant promise we've never heard before. So this is a tit for tat that goes on. But I think what we see there again is the immediate response from the coalition is around weakness. This is a weaker force. It's using that term again. So I think that's where we're at. PK, I think this is a perfect time to bring in our guest. What do you think?
Let's do it. Kate McClymont is the Chief Investigative Reporter at the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome to the Party Room.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate, it's great to have you on the Party Room finally in what's been a really, really difficult week for Australians. I want to start with the Bondi Junction attack. To quote the PM, this was not an act of terrorism, but it was terrifying, which I think summed it up pretty well. On Saturday night, the Prime Minister addressed the nation. He was flanked by the AFP Commissioner.
Staff for whom this should have been a normal shift, shoppers peacefully going about their lives, and yet for these Australians their first instinct in the face of danger was to help someone else. That is what we hold on to tonight as Australians. That's confirmation of who we are, brave, strong, together.
So, Kate, the PM was sort of leaning into the positives and delivered a message of sort of reassurance, really. How do you think our political leaders, including the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, have responded and handled this attack?
Look, I think that they've done it very well. And your listeners may recall that Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, was in fact on holidays with his family in Japan and did the right thing by saying, right, hopping on a plane straight away. And I think people always appreciate when our political leaders do that. But then, you know, you think that it's all going well, and then we've had the little bit of a misstep whereby the Prime Minister very kindly offered residency to, you know, Bollard Man, a French citizen, Damien Gouraud. And then it's been revealed that this morning that the Pakistani security guard, Mohammed Taha, who also, you know, tried to fend off Joel Gauchi, he was not offered the same.
He's going to get it now, though, isn't he?
I think he is going to get it now. But it's one of those things where there's always a little bit of a booby trap waiting for you somewhere along the line. But I think in general, it's been handled very well.
And as we said, terror was quickly ruled out in the Bondi attack, but the New South Wales government announced an additional $18 million for a coronial inquest into what had caused or contributed to the tragic event. Now, Joel Gauchi, the man who committed these crimes, had ongoing mental health issues. He was from Queensland. We know from his family that he dealt with these mental health issues since he was a teenager. No fixed address. Will an incident like this lead to a national mental health kind of shake-up, Kate, or should it?
Well, it's interesting that $18 million has been announced to go into the a coronial investigation. But I got an email from Professor Leanne Tozier from Sydney University saying, look, you know, that's fine, but we need $400,000 for our psychiatry, our online psychiatry services for country people. You know, just raising the point that there's a pressing need to actually spend money helping people with psychiatric issues, whether from, you know, brain injury or, you know, mental health issues. So there's so much money that needs to be spent looking at this. And we've also, you know, we'll move on to the 16-year-old boy who has allegedly stabbed a priest. And you sort of think, gee, there needs to be money spent, especially on, you know, youth issues as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's been, we'll get to that now. PK and I have been discussing a fair bit the alleged stabbing in the church that happened in the wake of the Bondi attack. But there are a lot of issues here. I mean, that was quickly deemed a terror incident, so it's different to the Bondi attack. Muslim community leaders condemned the attack and raised concerns about young people in their communities being radicalised. Here they are.
This is not a new issue, as we're all fully aware. We definitely don't want to go back to those bad old days. It's something where we as a community, and I mean we in the Australian context, we need to address. We've reached out to different forms of government and other associations. And look, we don't want to bury our head in the sand. There is an issue. It needs to be addressed, and we are committed to addressing it.
That's Gamal Kier, Secretary of the Lebanese Muslim Association, speaking to PK on Breakfast. Kate, we definitely don't want to go back to the bad old days. You know, remember in 2015 when Curtis Cheng was shot and killed by a 15-year-old in an ISIS-inspired attack. There were other attacks over those years, young Australians going over to fight with ISIS. It was just a terrible time, particularly for the Muslim community, but also those who they sought to harm. You know, are we better equipped this time around to head it off?
Look, I'm not sure that we are. I know that we are more aware of incidents like this happening, especially after the murder of police accountant Curtis Cheng. But the thing is, a lot of these things are done, you know, down deep burrows on the internet. And actually monitoring these things can prove very difficult. For instance, with, you know, in relation to the young 16-year-old who has allegedly stabbed the Assyrian priest, he was known but not well known to the police. And the reason he was known to police was that he had previous incidents with knives. And it's one of those things that even though last year the New South Wales Parliament actually beefed up their penalties for possessing or wielding a knife in a public place, you know, say a school or somewhere like that, it's now can attract 4 years jail just to wield a knife. I don't think these people are reading these things or being, you know, aware that you can actually go to jail just for having a knife in a public place.
Or care. I mean, the issue here is not so much the knife as the radicalisation, isn't it?
Well, exactly. But it's also having the ability to have a weapon like a knife. I know that we in Australia are very pleased about our gun laws. And I think the thing about Bondi Junction was it's so disturbing to think that so much carnage could be inflicted in such a short amount of time just with a knife.
And that was really the truly chilling part of it. I want to go to the reaction of the Muslim community, and they feel really upset that the police kind of rushed to call it a terror incident, and they feel like there's almost been different treatment of the two events. Kate, how do we navigate that in terms of social cohesion, and are they right with the police just too quick on that?
Look, I think that they probably were too quick. Having said that, the young man allegedly took issue with what the priest was saying, But separating that off from somebody who is probably a troubled young man, in moving it further on to being a terrorist incident, I think that it's just too early to make those kind of distinctions. And I think it does have the capacity to quickly inflame the situation.
They must have thought about that carefully though, Kate. I mean, why a terror act and why not a hate crime? You know, their explanation for that is that they wanted the extra powers, basically, that come with a proclaiming something terrorist act.
Look, possibly that's right, that they did need the extra powers, because don't forget, it was quite a confronting scene for police, just dealing with the angry people outside the church that night once news spread of what had happened. And I think there were, you know, two or three police were hospitalised. I think every single police of the 40 police cars that went, they were nearly all, you know, quite badly damaged. So I think when the inflammation of, you know, the possible escalation and inflammation of societal feelings, maybe they declare it that exactly as you're saying, to give extra powers. But you sort of think, does it inflame it by just calling it a terrorist attack?
Whether it's the right thing or not, I don't have the evidence in front of me and I won't make pass judgment, but I know that it has inflamed the situation. That's a fact, because the community says so, right? And they feel like there's a double standard. Yeah. I suppose both of the events are tragic. Anyone who's suffered at the hands of anyone who's violent deserves justice. And, you know, I think that the resources are across the board are being provided. But there is a big thing with social cohesion at the moment, particularly in the wake of the war in Gaza and the way communities are fraying, Kate. How big a challenge is that element?
Oh, well, where do you even start? I think that even what's happening in Israel and in Gaza, just seeing the fracturing of friendships between people on the other side of the world, I sort of wonder what's going on in our society when you can't seem to have civilized conversations without people wanting to be on one side or the other, when there are nuances in both. And it worries me to see this happening. You know, I know of friendships that have broken down over what's happening in the Middle East, and I think that's a worry.
Kate, this story will go on, and I think the ripples of it, the ramifications of it will go on. But there's another big story this week too that I think has long-lasting implications. The judgment in the defamation trial Bruce Lemon brought against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson, in a bombshell ruling, the federal court judge, Justice Lee, found that on the balance of probabilities, Bruce Lemon raped Brittany Higgins in Parliament House in 2019. He labelled the whole case an omni-shambles. And Justice Lee's 2.5-hour judgment, I think you have to say, was electrifying, including many memorable lines like this one.
Having escaped the lion's den, Mr. Lerman made the mistake of coming back for his hat.
Now, everyone picked up on that, but you've been following this case extremely closely. How did you respond to Justice Lee's judgment, particularly when he got to that final judgment of Bruce Lerman raped Brittany Higgins?
Look, it was a fascinating judgment on many, many levels. Like, one, it was a judgment on how our media industry had behaved. For Bruce Lerman, hearing Michael Lee say Bruce Lerman raped Brittany Higgins, like, that would have been absolutely devastating. But I found the way that, in a common sense manner, Justice Lee put all these things together. And he also talked really interestingly about the effect of trauma on, you know, rape victims. I just thought all that was really interesting. For instance, his common sense view of what happened on the night in March 2019 in Parliament House. And, you know, he said things like, you know, Bruce Lerman's explanation that he'd left his car keys at home, or that he was, you know, brushing up on French submarine contracts.
Submarine policy.
And he said that nothing good ever happens after 2 a.m. And this was absolutely no exception. But I think for Channel 10, when he said Brittany Higgins gave inconsistent evidence in a lot of things after what happened on that night. But hearing her in the witness box before me, what she said has not changed. You know, I've looked at her other accounts and it had the ring of truth about it. And that was really at the crux of the matter, that the initial project broadcast in which Bruce Lemon was not named, but he was identified, that was found to have been true. And that got Channel 10 out of a whole lot of other problems about whether their journalism had been reasonable.
Mm. It was quite the ruling, really. There's so many scalps here. There's so many people who've been damaged by this case. Does it settle it finally, Kate?
No. This is, I'm sort of tearing my hair out. I just sort of think I have never seen anything like this, as you said, where it's almost anyone who comes in contact with this case, it comes back to bite them. I'm feeling a little bit nervous myself, really. But just in the last couple of days, we've seen the Channel 7 producer, Taylor Auerbach, who was the last minute witness for Channel 10 when they reopened their case lately. He's filed another concerns notice, which is the first steps in defamation against, Channel 7 bosses. So, you know, that's another sort of strange development. We've got Linda Reynolds, the former Liberal Defence Minister. She's saying that it looks like she's still going full steam ahead in her defamation action against Brittany Higgins and her partner. I mean, the ripple effects, we've just seen Mark Llewellyn, the executive producer of Spotlight, as Channel 7 put out a press statement, as Justice Lee was reading his judgment, he is no longer at the network. And of course, Mark Llewellyn was the executive producer when inducements were being offered to Bruce Lemon for his tell-all interview. And I just think the media has come out of this, you know, very badly in some ways. I just think when Justice Lee remarked recently that sunlight was the best disinfectant, I think it's the same with our media industry. Having practices where you are giving money to people for interviews, that's one thing. But then to cover up that you've done that is another thing. And I don't think we're going to get rid of checkbook journalism in this country. But I think if someone is paid or given a gratuity or paid via a consultancy, I think the media have to be upfront and say this interview was paid for, just so that viewers or listeners can make their own decision about the ethical concerns and the validity of that particular interview.
Yeah, well, Channel 7 didn't come off well, neither did Channel 10 and Lisa Wilkinson. But, Kate, just before we wrap up, I mean, two questions that remain really is do you think that Bruce Lemon will appeal? Because I know some are concerned that he will. And the other question, that two former judges now suggesting that Brittany Higgins' compensation payout from the government could perhaps or should be investigated by the National Anti-Corruption Commission. Do you think that's likely?
Look, I think that's very unlikely. I think following Justice Lee's decision, you know, basically in which he said that Higgins and her partner David Shiraz had been pushing a narrative of a political cover-up to the media from 2021 onwards, he could not find any evidence that those allegations were true. But having said that, I'm not sure that Brittany Higgins's payment, which involved those claims, was an act of corruption on the part of a government organisation. Mm. Brittany Higgins might not have, you know, told the truth about that. I'm not saying that she did or she didn't, but whether that amounts to a systemic corruption, I'm just not sure whether that would get over the line. And I don't think that the federal government wants to go back into this.
I'm sure they don't.
I think so many people are ready to put this behind them, and it would be good to allow people to move on with their lives too. Kate, thank you so much for joining the podcast. It's been great to pick your brain.
Oh, it's been my pleasure indeed, and lovely talking to you both.
Thanks, Kate. See ya.
Okay, bye-bye.
Fran, isn't she just terrific? It was so good to finally get her on the podcast.
I know, like I said, she's a legend. She's a legend.
Such a big brain and such a good reporter. Look, I want to just mention a story that I hope continues to be vigorously pursued by reporters across the country. News broke on Wednesday night. We reported it on Breakfast and at the ABC throughout Thursday morning, that a 10-year-old Indigenous boy had taken his own life while in the care of the WA state government. Now, when I say the care, he was living with relatives and he was in essentially what they call kinship care. But this is a 10-year-old. It's beyond anyone's comprehension, a child that young being in such a state of despair to take their own life. And I know this is a difficult conversation, but I think it's important to raise on this podcast because I think that deserves a lot of attention at a national level and a political level. Last year, there was a failed referendum. We now are in the next year. We move on from that and accept the nation's verdict. But we are now in a situation where children are still clearly not safe in this country. It doesn't The circumstances will all be poured over in an inquiry, but there has to be a broader national look at this because child protection services are failing Aboriginal kids throughout the country. Mm. This is a real thing that's happening, and Aboriginal people have been begging us to take to look at this and to give it the attention it deserves. And I think it's incumbent on us to do it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is an investigation, an inquiry in New South Wales at the moment, and it is finding that the child protection system does not work in support of Aboriginal families and Aboriginal children. We've had an investigation into youth suicide, Indigenous suicide in WA in the past, and the findings were stark. And it's not like we don't know what's going on here. I mean, the Closing the Gap updates, the most recent updates show that suicide rates amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians has been going up, not down, for a decade. This is despite the inquiries that we've had into this. So, you know, something is urgently wrong in the child protection system and beyond.
It's very serious. And so, you know, we will keep pursuing this story. Anyone who's found this story confronting and difficult, and I suspect many of you have, Lifeline can be accessed 13 11 14. And of course, for any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders listening, 13 Yarn is also there, 13 92 76. Let's take some questions.
Let's do it.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
And it's time for our question time because the bells are ringing. And we've got a question from Raymond. And Raymond says, I've got a question about the Governor-General. Do Governor-Generals receive any training instruction in constitutional convention prior to assuming their role, or do they just dive into it and have advisers to guide them as they go? I am not aware of any specific training session they're given. I suppose they can ask.
I'm not aware, but I imagine they do. I mean, it's a very big change of role, and I think we've seen that in the latest pick for Governor-General. Sam Mostyn has been chosen by Anthony Albanese. You know, she's an unusual pick in the sense that she's not a former governor or a former army commander or a former judge of the High Court or otherwise. So she's out of that mould. She is more an activist and advocate across a range of issues, but she's got broad experience across the society and across the community. So, you know, she will, you know, obviously when you're Governor General, you cannot be a political advocate in any way. You need to curb that dimension of your opinion. But having said that, Sam Mostyn has clearly been a community leader across many, many elements, as I say, with, you know, displaying compassion, intelligence, wisdom, empathy. All these are great qualities for a Governor General. So I imagine she'll get a crash course in constitutional convention because she probably is not an expert in that area, but I'm not sure how or when that occurs.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a ceremonial role, really. That's the Governor General's role in our system. It's constitution, baby. I always keep it in the bathroom.
You are not telling me you have the constitution in your bathroom.
I do.
You can fact check it with my partner. I have it in the bathroom.
Wow.
Send your questions in because we love getting them. We're especially fond of voice notes, which you can email to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, and remember to always follow The Party Room on the ABC Listen app so you never miss an episode.
Can't wait to next week, and it's great that we're back together again, Fran. See ya.
Love it. See you, PK.